Hello and welcome to another installment of History Hack. I'm absolutely thrilled today because I told Alina who I would love to get on this program, and she went and convinced him. We have with us Roger Crowley, who is an award-winning author, historian, and broadcaster. He's written books such as Mediterranean, Constantinople, The Last Great Siege, Empires of the Sea, which was a New York Times bestseller, and the Sunday Times Book of the Year. But today he's here to help us fill a gap that we have mournfully neglected, which is Portuguese history, because Roger has also written a book called Conquerors: How Portugal Seized the Indian Ocean and Forged the First Global Empire. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Roger, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to participate in your absolutely heroic podcast mission. I'm staggered by the amount of stuff you do.
I can't believe we're up to nearly 500 episodes and we haven't got Portugal in yet. So when he said, yes, what book? What book? I was like, Portugal, Portugal. But I guess for our listeners, because it's not something that a lot we know, I think everybody who knows something about the British Empire know the Portuguese were around. But can you set the scene for us? So in the early part of the 15th century, Portugal is actually a small and rather poor country, isn't it?
Yeah, Portugal was marginal to Europe. It's locked out of the Mediterranean, very small country, population of about 1 million people, too poor to in natural resources, even to mint gold coins. And yet it has a precocious sense of national identity. The Portuguese had expelled the Moorish population from their country earlier than Spanish had, and they had a unified country with its with national borders, which were set by the end of the 14th century. A new dynasty comes along called the House of Aviz, and this is the kings of this new dynasty are going to unite Portugal. Portugal, long Atlantic coastline, no natural resources. The Portuguese have one skill, and that is sailing. They have no option but to step out into the horrible, rough, violent Atlantic Ocean and fish for stuff. And their navigational and sailing skills are really going to be the thing which provide the launch pad for the Portuguese to do extraordinary things.
They start off with they want to get to India, don't they?
It's an evolving project for the Portuguese. They start out in the early 15th century under the guy that we call Henry the Navigator, although that was a 19th century romantic term. And as far as I can make out, he only ever stepped onto a ship twice for very short journeys. But their first aim was to get round the Islamic world, which is now a barrier. All the way from Constantinople in the east, along the shores of North Africa, and they know that somewhere on the other, that further down Africa, there is gold. They have access to maps produced by Jewish cartographers in Majorca, which have this wonderful picture of the King of Mali holding up an enormous lump of gold, and this kind of inspires them to start making journeys down the African coast to try and seek sources of gold. At the same time, they're embarking on another really unfortunate for world history project, which is slaving local people. And so there's kind of all sorts of things mixed up in the Portuguese venture. But they slowly, during the 15th century, journey after journey, work their way down the African coast, and they work out how to make these journeys. They start to map them, and they also work out how to manage the Atlantic winds. You can make your way down the coast of Africa, easy sailing. Coming back up the coast of Africa is really hard work against the wind. So they have to counterintuitively work out that you have to make what the Portuguese call the sea turn. You go out into the Atlantic, quite frightening, away from land, and a wind will pick you up and sweep you back to Portugal. So they're starting to crack the code of the Atlantic winds, which is going to be critical, really, to making long voyages across the Atlantic and eventually working their way round the Cape of Good Hope into the Indian Ocean.
It's a monumental achievement for such a small country, isn't it? Is there some action up in Morocco, in Egypt as well?
Well, in Morocco, yeah, the Portuguese are nuts about crusading, it has to be said. And those people who are not voyaging are waging continuous battles with crusading warfare in Morocco. And it was very much a part of the noble esprit de corps, if you like, to go to Morocco and sort of try and conquer some Islamic strongholds. And the honor code runs very deeply through the Portuguese nobility. And there are stories of Portuguese noblemen about to attack a fortress in Morocco, being arguing so strongly between themselves, who's going to be the first person up the ladder onto the walls, that they all get killed. So they're kind of a mixture of medieval people who have this whole chivalric anti-Islamic crusading thing, and modern people who are extremely good at sailing, cartography, and scientific navigation techniques. They're a kind of mixture of two worlds there.
I'm really interested to know, do they ever clash with the Spanish? Because the Spanish are really active at this point, aren't they?
They do. In the 1470s, they're fighting the Spanish both on land and at sea. The running battles with Spain, or Castile as it then was, have been running for 100 years at least. They repulsed the Spanish in their sort of Agincourt moment at the end of the 14th century, the Battle of Aljubarrota. And the great factoid for me in this is that actually there was a band of English archers there who came from just outside Gloucester, from where I live. And one of those archers, one of those men, is going to turn out to be the grandfather of Vasco da Gama. So I lay a claim for the Vasco da Gama was actually that India was discovered by a man from Gloucestershire. Anyway, in the 15th century, yes, they're fighting on land and they're fighting at sea. For the offshore islands, the Canaries and so on. And eventually they sort of carve a notional line through the ocean. We'll do this bit, you do that bit. But this, the love-hate relationship between the two runs continuously throughout their history. Portuguese princesses are marrying Castilian kings. So there's kind of attraction and repulsion goes on continuously. It's very strange.
They can't get away from them, can they?
They can't, no. I mean, it's, you know, they're sort of bonded together, really, and their nobilities are intertwined.
Doesn't Henry VIII marry his sister into Portugal as well?
It's the oldest alliance between, they say, between England and Portugal, both Atlantic peoples, seafaring peoples, and they've had this very strong connection right down to the port business in the 18th century.
So the Portuguese are trying to get into Africa and dominate the Indian Ocean. How long does it take for them to achieve this? And is their stay there successful?
It takes them about 70 years to work out how to make their way round Africa. And so if they were starting to make voyages in the 1530s, Vasco da Gama sets out in 1497, makes his way around the Cape of Good Hope, along the east coast of Africa, discovers a pilot, Islamic pilot, to take them across the Indian Ocean, and arrives at a town called city called Calicut. And immediately there is trouble, really, because there's a lot of stuff behind this, but they expected to find a sea full of Christian people. You might ask why. Well, it's a long story, but involves mythical idea of a king called Prester John. And they find to their horror that all the trade in the Indian Ocean is really run by Islamic merchants. And the upshot of this is that very quickly they arrive at this city called Calicut. It's an extraordinary moment, actually. This has been the dream of people from Europe since the time of Marco Polo, to get the riches of the East, to have access to the spices and silk and so on. And the Portuguese turn up on three ships and they've discovered this place. And it's almost like Europe being seen down the wrong end of a telescope, because they arrive and they send a man ashore, usually send the most disposable man you can find, who's either a prisoner or a Jew. And so they send the Jewish guy ashore, and a man speaks to him in Castilian, an Arab merchant, says, "What on earth are you doing here?" And the fact is that Islamic trading network was hugely long range. This guy had came from Morocco. He traded with Spain. And so, you know, it's kind of a humbling moment. You know, we talk about the age of discoveries, but we could probably just talk about the age of the end of European isolation and ignorance would probably be another way of looking at it. But they very quickly they get themselves into trouble and into conflict with the Raja of Calicut. They want to demand, they're coming as with their conquistador helmets on, if you like, monopoly trading. You know, you've got to cut the Muslim merchants out of this. He won't do this. And so we see in that expedition and a series of expeditions year by year, deteriorating relationships between the sultans and rajas on the west coast of India and the Portuguese, who really are coming again with this crusader mentality, expel the Muslims, and a belief that they should have unique monopoly trading rights for the spice trade. They're really an interruption to thousands of years of long distance trade between Egypt and China. And the Indian Ocean was a kind of free trade commonwealth with no armed warfare. Of course, Portuguese bring what the Spanish brought to South America, which is fast firing gunpowder weapons. Although in India they did have gunpowder weapons, nobody had gunpowder weapons on ships. And so the three ships that Vasco da Gama brings and his successors can really blast anybody out of the water. So it's you know, there's technology in here as well that is part of the mix in this. But very quickly you start to see relations deteriorating, and it's quite clear that the Portuguese, if they want a foothold on the coast of India, are going to have to fight for it. And they do some fairly dreadful things along the way, rather like the Spanish conquistadors in the Americas.
Yeah, so the initial way of gaining a monopoly over trade doesn't work. They just don't seem to get it, how it works in the region. So they resort to brute force. Does it work?
Up to a point it works, yes. They are successful in establishing, it's a mixture there. They were actually very good at gathering information, the Portuguese. They had a lot of practice down the coast of Africa. And they worked out in the space of about 15 years, no access to Google Maps. They couldn't look, or Google Earth. They couldn't look down on the Indian Ocean and say, these are the important ports all the way around the Indian Ocean that we need to control. But they worked out very quickly by asking questions, by learning languages, but also by gunfire, bombarding places into submission, sea battles and so on. And they also work out the politics of the Malabar coast, southern India, that the Raja of Calicut is at odds with the Raja of Cochin further down the coast. And so they start to do deals with one sultan, or actually these are Hindus, so Rajas is perhaps the word to use here, to kind of divide and rule and establish a presence. And they do this really quite quickly. They send a fleet out every year. Once they've worked out the rhythm of the monsoon winds, leaves Lisbon in March, arrives in India in September, makes a return journey in January. It's a 24,000 mile round trip. You know, it's a huge operation, incredibly difficult to do. But the Portuguese, I think what the Portuguese like more than anything else actually is to be 500 men in a fort, surrounded by sort of 50,000 Hindu warriors and fighting for their lives. They are sort of kind of nuts, actually, in many ways.
They like to do it Bernard Cornwell style.
They certainly do, yes. they certainly do. I mean, the most extraordinary case of this guy called Duarte Pacheco Pereira. He's left to defend Cochin. Portuguese, further down the coast from Calicut, the ruler of Calicut and the ruler of Cochin are at odds with each other. So he's done a deal with Cochin, and he's left with 150 men it's a strip of land surrounded by lagoon just on the coast. And the army of Calicut advances with 50,000 men. And it's kind of the Portuguese Thermopylae, actually. He's a very bright guy. This is a guy who he's unlike many of the Portuguese conquistadors. He's actually a very he's a sort of early scientist, cartographer, astronomer, mathematician. And because Cochin is surrounded by these tidal lagoons, he's probably one of the first person to work out the relationship between tides and the phases of the moon. And he works out that they that the warriors of Calicut can only attack Cochin at certain crossing points, at certain phases of the tide. So he can move his 150 men around according to the tidal flow. And they're armed with, gunpowder weapons. And they managed to see off this vast force. It was an extraordinary achievement. Pereira is interesting, really. He is an observer, and many of the Portuguese were. For example, he's the first man to observe and record chimpanzees using primitive tools to carry out operations. So they're gathering, they're not just, head-banging, brutal incomers. There is a mix in this, a process of discovering and describing the world. And Pereira writes a book about this, actually. So they're actually adding to the knowledge stock, European knowledge stock. And a lot of this stuff will be translated into other European languages in the 16th century. They're observers as well as fighters, I think.
I have to ask, you've mentioned crusading a couple of times already. Just how much of a role does religion play in the expansion of the Portuguese Empire?
It plays a huge role on two levels. The first level is... just going back into the history of the Crusades, by the time that the Crusaders have been thrown out of the Holy Land, they have realized that a geostrategic idea emerges that if you could outflank the Islamic world and attack Islam from behind, you might be able to destroy it. Now, and during the process of the voyages of exploration, they make their way into the Indian Ocean. And King Manuel of Portugal, the man who really runs the voyages of exploration, who is full of messianic dreams of being the Christian emperor of the world, comes up with this weird geosynth. You know, he doesn't think small. His idea is to... once he's made his way into the Indian Ocean, that the Portuguese should make their way up the Red Sea, kidnap the body of the Prophet Muhammad from Medina, hold it to ransom and get Jerusalem back. Extraordinary dream. There is this kind of weird crusading thing running through his thing. Not, I have to say, not shared by many Portuguese who just wanted to go to India and get the stuff. But at the same time, because they come into the Indian Ocean as enemies of the Islamic world and Islam, the Islamic Indian Ocean is a fact, and they find themselves in direct contest with Islamic people, they are guilty of extraordinary sort of signal atrocities, one of which was... Vasco da Gama coming across a boatload of pilgrims returning from the Hajj in Mecca called the Miri, and burning the ship and all its crew, men, women and children alive, which is going to remain something that is going to be remembered by later Indian historians as we enter into a post-colonial world. We see the burning of mosques on the coast of India with people in them and so on. And so we see terrible things happening in the same way that the Spanish were doing in South America. After a while, it calms down a bit, I have to say, and wiser heads come along and work out that it is better to... The problem for the Portuguese, unlike the Spanish, is that this is a tiny country. There are never more than about 2,000 or 3,000 men in the Indian Ocean at any one time. And the ability to control, this vast terrain by brute force is just not on. So they come up with two policies. One is fortress-based policy. So you have a very strong fortress on dotted along the coast of India and indeed on the coast of Africa, which you can defend. And the other wiser policy, which they develop and sort of weirdly enlightened over the course of time, is that you have to come to terms a bit with the Islamic world. And certainly in the case of Calicut and later Goa, they come up with the idea that if you send, this is not like the Mayflower where people go to America, men, women and children. This is an exploration solely by men, really. And the guy who looks at this is a later a governor of India called Afonso de Albuquerque. And he realizes that if you have men and with no women, in a place like Goa, you're going to have trouble, you're going to have rapes, you're going to have all sorts of things. So he actually encourages a mixed marriage policy, much to the dislike of the Catholic Church. The women have to convert to Christianity. So one of the contributions, if you can put it like this, to the dark and very mixed story of European colonialism is that the Portuguese are really the creators of mixed race societies, actually, and you'll see the same in Brazil and so on. So, you know, there are sort of strange things happening here. But the signal fact is that they say of the Portuguese, a small people with a whole world to die in, you know, there are never very many of them. The population is just not large enough to colonize land. All they can do is hold down fortress. This is landfalls on the coast. They do, of course, manage in the long run in Brazil to establish a territorial empire. But everywhere else, the Portuguese are just dotted along the coast doing trading things. And that policy towards the Islamic world starts to soften and a sort of more cultural method of controlling people or interacting with people starts to emerge in the 16th century. But you have to say that an awful lot of ghastly things went on along the way.
There are other problems that the Portuguese ended up facing. One of them was long journeys to India. What did these journeys look like? How many people on average end up surviving them?
Well, these journeys look like hell, I have to say, although probably not as awful as the journeys that the Spanish were subsequently making across the Pacific Ocean. But you set out from Lisbon in March. You spend 90 days at sea, seeing no land. You do an enormous swing out into the Atlantic Ocean, almost to Brazil. And in fact, they discovered the Brazil as part of that process. The wind carries you around to the tip of Africa. The 90 days at sea is dangerous because you can't keep fresh food going for that long, and the danger for all long distance voyages is scurvy, which will start to kill people after about 80 days. So and this is before you have the storm thrown in. You then work your way up the coast of Africa, stopping at various ports along the way, hopefully if you can persuade people or you can bombard people into being helpful, and then you make your way across the Indian Ocean with the monsoon wind. The shipwreck statistic is huge. I think about 35% of all the people who went out in the first 5 years died in shipwrecks. And there's a whole Portuguese literature actually from the 16th century called The Tragic History of the Sea, which is about these tales of people being wrecked off on the coasts of Namibia or somewhere and crawling away and dying cannibalism and so on. And the strange thing is that the longer these voyages went on into the 16th century, the greater the shipwreck statistic became. And there are various explanations for that. The ships got bigger and less maneuverable and so on. But actually making the voyage is really, really tough. And of course, they hadn't worked out about scurvy. They accidentally discover when they get round the Cape of Good Hope, they Moa and various places, and they start to eat oranges and so on. And they think, oh, well, it's because the air is better here. And it's going to be a long while before sailors work out that what you need is a bit of lime juice or even, you know, some cloves or something. So it's always tough going, really. It requires formidable sailing skills, which the Portuguese had. But none of this is ever easy.
And yet, you've mentioned Brazil. What is the extent of their empire at its height?
At the height of its empire, it's really footholds all the way around Africa, the mouth of the Persian Gulf, all the way down the coast of India to Malacca, on the western coast of Malaya, and then on into the Spice Islands in the Indonesian archipelago, and then to the west it is going to be the one place that they do colonize, although very slowly over a long period of time, is going to be Brazil. And all sorts of little smatterings of places on the west coast of Africa, in what is now Nigeria, and in later centuries they will have Mozambique, for example, and on the west coast of Africa as well. But in the historic Portuguese period, if you look at a map of Portuguese colonialization in the, say, the 17th or 16th century, you get a series of little dots all the way around the coast from Lisbon to Malaya and beyond, and a larger growing green area in Brazil, and that's it. If you compare the Spanish colonial map of the same period, you get a vast area of red, or whatever color you want it, you know, across the Americas.
So, is it because they lack the numbers? Is that why they never penetrate the interior anymore of
Yeah. They just don't have the people. And it is the most improbable empire, really. And it is extraordinary, if you want to be... Well, it's difficult not to talk about this in the post-colonial way now, but it was in terms of the skill, the knowledge... it was a freak, really. And you know, the guy who meets the first person who comes ashore at Calicut, sent by Vasco da Gama, he not only says, "What on earth are you doing here? Why is it not Venice or the King of Spain? You know, why you? You know, you're nobody. You know, this is a tiny place." But the Portuguese, in terms of historiography, feel very sore about the fact that they did extraordinary things in the world, and yet their whole narrative has been trumped by the Columbus story. And part of that relationship between Spain and Portugal is very interesting, in the sense that Columbus learnt all his sailing in Portugal. He was married to a Portuguese woman, and he made voyages down the African coast on Portuguese ships, and he'd lobbied the King of Spain, King John, to make the journey westward. And John turned him down because John and his cartographers, he had very bright cosmographers, Jewish cosmographers, who decided that Columbus's idea that, you know, it was 90 days sailing to Japan or something was just wrong. He'd made the world 25% too small, which indeed he had. So in the end, Columbus has to go to the King of Castile and bend his ear, who agrees to fund the journey. And of course, he discovers India, in inverted commas, which is really the Bahamas and, you know, bits of the Dominican Republic and so on. And it's, you know, it's kind of quite a long time before people realize that Columbus isn't anywhere near the the Columbus story, of course, has trumped the Portuguese. I mean, what Columbus did sailing across the Atlantic was, you know, brave and stepping out into the unknown as well. But I think the Portuguese story has been rather neglected, actually. And there's a long once we've dealt with the dark side of this, and there is a dark side to the Portuguese story, they create the Atlantic slave trade, yeah. And there is a building on the Algarve at Lagos, which was the first slave trading, whatever you want to call it, building in the world. And if you want to call the classical moment for the start of the slave trade is, I think it's 1444, when 250 African slaves are unloaded on the beach there. And because the investors in the journey all have a share, the African people are divided into five groups. So women are separated from children and so on. And it's terribly distressing to read about. But the man who wrote it at the time, of course, doesn't quite see it like this, because he ends up by saying, the good thing was that we've saved their souls for the Christian faith. So there is that dark side to the Portuguese story. Yeah. The other dark side really is going to be that they move between 3 and 5 million people. Well, it's the same story, really. They are the inventors of the Atlantic slave trade, which is going to be taken over by the English and the Dutch. They move between 3 and 5 million people to Brazil over a 200 or 300 year period. They do all sorts of other things. This think of the Portuguese Empire as a network rather than a colonial thing. Mm. And the network does all sorts of other things. It moves crop species around the world. For example, it moves maize from the Americas to Africa, which will have a long-term positive effect on the diet of African people. Foodstuffs, technologies. It introduces firearms into Japan, not exactly a great contribution. Astronomical instruments into China. And really, by the network, by the second half of the 16th century, a Portuguese nobleman can order a dinner set from a Ming potter. And through a series of middlemen, you start to see the goods of the East starting to appear in Europe. A lens from Germany can be exported to Indian kings, and an elephant. There's quite famous little episode involving exotic animals arriving in Portugal. Afonso de Albuquerque, who's governor, sends the king of Portugal an elephant. And this elephant becomes the animal superstar of the early 16th century. Manuel sends it to the Pope as a kind of as a present, but also as a bit of Portuguese PR. And it arrives in Rome with an Indian team of Indians leading and riding this thing. Great show of Oriental splendor and so on. And the Pope is delighted with his elephant. Not least because you give it a bucket of water, it will spray water all over the cardinals. there's a famous drawing of the elephant by Raphael, I think it is. And there are poems written about it. He's called Hanno, after Hannibal. And but unfortunately, they don't really understand animal management or elephant diet very well. And they feed it a laxative of gold, which rather finishes off poor old Hanno. The follow-up gift was a rhinoceros, but the rhinoceros gets drowned, unfortunately, just in a shipwreck off the coast of Italy. And famous picture by Durer, which is very strange because Durer never saw the rhinoceros, but somebody had sent him a sketch of it and produces a very famous print of this rhinoceros. And this is not since the Romans have we seen some of these creatures coming into the coming into Europe. So Lisbon becomes an extraordinary exotic place. Mm. And this is really part of the whole explosion of the European imagination about the way the world works, what's in it, the amount of writing that is starting to be generated. And really it feeds into the whole enlarging 16th century story of the age of exploration. So there are good things in this, if you can call them good things, although, you know, we're now obviously having to reverse engineering what that means. but it certainly was, they made a major contribution to the globalization of peoples, of knowledge, of crops, of foodstuffs, of technologies. Not alone, the Spanish were doing it as well, and then obviously the English and the Dutch will join in afterwards. But they are they're really a front runner in many ways.
So just tell us a little bit about, so they are overstretched. The whole thing is a freak, as you say. Tell us about the decline then.
Well, the decline is going to come when the English and the Dutch, if we're talking about India and beyond, cotton onto the game. And the Dutch, particularly the coming of the Dutch Golden Age at the end of the 16th, early 17th century. We have to say the Portuguese, going back to the religious thing, were keen in converting people to Christianity, and the Jesuits set up in Goa and sent out great missions to convert people. The Dutch really steal all the industrial information that the Portuguese have. Portuguese make a big effort to try and redact information. Ships that come back from the Indies to Lisbon, their maps and their charts are confiscated, and they're trying to stop this leakage of information about how you get there, but they couldn't. And particularly when the Dutch come along, the Dutch actually are extremely ruthless, and they are guilty of terrible acts of genocide, certainly in the Spice Islands, in the Indonesian archipelago. And they dismantle a great part of the Indian Ocean empire of the Portuguese fairly quickly. And so they lose Malacca, they lose a lot of the spice trade to the Dutch, who really monopolize this for a 200-year period. And the money drains through the hands of the Portuguese, because what lies behind this is that we think of the Portuguese as being on their own, but actually this is a story of Europe at this time. And what is happening is that from the beginning of the 16th century, what feeds into the Portuguese story is military technology. And a lot of this comes from Germany. The use of money, German and Italian bankers, the use of commercial know-how. And Portugal remains in many respects, like Spain, a society, a medieval society. It has a nobility and it has a peasant class. It never really develops an entrepreneurial middle class. A lot of the people who actually go out to work for the Portuguese are Genoese or Venetian or Dutch and so on. And Albuquerque says to Manuel at one point, "Sire, if you want a good agent in Goa, send for a man from Italy. He will cheat you, but he will do it far more effectively and efficiently than a man from Portugal." So the society doesn't develop. It remains kind of, frozen somehow. And the same for the Spanish. The money, all this wealth that comes into these countries, both Spain and Portugal, somehow slips through their fingers. And the wealth is kind of going to be, we're going to see the story of the 16th century is the action is going to move north. It's going to move to Holland. It's going to move to Germany, and it's going to move to England. We're going to see Spain, and Portugal, their empires are obviously going to continue right up into modern times. But the wealth is going to drain away, and it's going to drain away to really the Protestant peoples of Northern Europe, people who are not interested in converting people to Christianity quite so much, who are merchant venturers, much, much more efficient merchant venturers than the Portuguese were.
Roger, thank you so much for joining us. That was really enlightening. It's such a gap that we managed to plug. Alex got so excited that we had to get you on board to talk about this, because we haven't had very much Portuguese history. So thank you so much for being able to plug this gap for us.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed talking to you enormously, and may your podcast continue to enlighten and inform the world. It's a great job.
You can help us at History Hack by joining us via Patreon. It takes quite a lot of effort and a lot of work of quite a big team now to keep us going. And so if you could donate as little as £3 a month, it would be massively appreciated by all of us. There's different levels because Princess Marcus has set it all up with varying rewards and things. So do have a look, do join us. There's an exclusive Facebook group as well, and you can be part of all of it.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/hack history, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.